covering the Bay Area for 25 years. This is City Visions on KALW. I'm your host, Joseph Pache. If there's one thing most residents of the Bay Area can agree on, it's that we are in a housing crisis. Prices continue to rise, edging out those who'd like to live here and pushing out those who've been here for generations. When it comes to solutions, that's where opinions quickly diverge. There are those who want the Bay Area to grow in a way that provides access to housing for all income levels, while on the other hand, there's a growing movement that seeks to increase density and let market forces do the balancing. This movement is referred to as Yes in My Backyard, or YIMBYism, and YIMBY's enthusiastic pro-development stance has put them at odds with other community groups who tend to take more careful approaches about the type of development being built, among other things. Interestingly enough, like their opposition, the YIMBYs come out of the political left and share many of the same progressive values. So then who is a better steward for the Bay Area and its growth in years to come? Well, in our next hour, we'll have two sides tell their side of the story, and then you can decide. So first I want to introduce Laura Clark. She is president of Grow SF, and it is an organization that espouses a YIMBYism. Welcome, Laura, to the program.
Hi, thanks for having me.
And on the other side, I don't know, it's not like right-left here. on the other side of this debate is Fernando Marti, and he is co-founder of the Council of Community Housing Organizations. Welcome.
Co-director. Been around long before I was there.
Very good. Welcome to the program, Fernando.
Thank you.
All right. And we invite you, our listeners, as always, to join our conversation. We'll open our phone lines in about 20 minutes. And the number to dial to join our conversation is 415-841-4134. Again, that's 415-841-4134. You can email or text us now at cityvisions@kalw.org. Post a comment at the KALW website. You can also tweet us at City Visions KALW. What do you think should be done to increase Bay Area housing opportunities? Are you a young person who has come here for a job and struggling to manage with housing costs? Are you a homeowner who is concerned about the changes to your neighborhood? We want to hear from you. So Laura Clark of Grow SF, let's start with you. Did I do a good job describing sort of what the bottom line of YIMBYism is?
I think somewhat. I think the only thing I would push back on is to say that we're not enthusiastically pro-developer. We don't care about developers. We care about housing. If housing could be built by someone other than a developer, I would be for that, right? But, you know, by definition, all housing is built by developers. And by definition, most food is grown by farmers. We need a lot more housing throughout the Bay Area. While that means we end up sometimes being on the same side advocating for projects, we are doing it because we believe that we need a lot more housing throughout the Bay Area, because that is in the interest of renters, young people, low-income people. If we want diverse, vibrant communities, we need to address the shortage of housing that we are suffering throughout the Bay Area.
Okay, so you're looking for an increase primarily in density in San Francisco and perhaps in other parts of the Bay Area. Where did this movement come from?
I think it came out of frustration. I think a lot of people, a lot of young people who have moved to the Bay Area recently or have tried to move to the Bay Area and have been unable to, and especially sort of the upper, tech workers who are moving to the Bay Area because there are great jobs here and they're seeing a lot of that opportunity and know that their presence in the Bay Area causes displacement because we have spent 30 years chronically underbuilding housing. And they are frustrated with the fact that while they are moving here for opportunity, it means that they are taking away that opportunity from other people. And it doesn't have to be that way. We don't have to have a housing shortage. It doesn't have to be everyone scrambling for the same piece of pie. We can grow the pie. I think young people have been structurally locked out of housing market I think we see this as a long-term thing. Since the 90s, more and more people have been wanting to live in cities. We kind of learned the lesson that the suburbs are kind of depressing. The sprawl is awful, and we don't want to have to own cars. Young people have decided that urban lifestyles are good and healthy, and I think that that's borne out in the data. You can be a healthier, more healthy, literally healthier person, and also greener. You have a lower carbon count if you live in a dense urban environment. And instead of that opportunity being available to all, it's available to a small minority. And we don't think that that's the way it has to be.
So let's focus on this point. You've brought up young people. So what age group are we talking about here when you say young people?
Stunted millennials. I think are probably the biggest contingent of our group are people who are probably between the ages of 25 and 35 is the biggest, although we have YIMBYs at every age. But that's kind of the biggest of our volunteers and people who come out a lot, maybe 35 to 45. There are a lot of people who feel like, they're making pretty decent money, and yet they still can't afford to buy a home in the Bay Area. And they're kind of like, what is going on here?
So what's the median income of people in that are espousing this? Just so I'm trying to get a sense
of our demographics, volunteers.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It's really interesting because we do have volunteers, everyone from like formerly homeless who come out and volunteer with us regularly, up to people making, $200,000 probably is like the largest of people who do the work. I mean, I'm sure we've had donations from people who are richer, but I would say most of the people are people making sort of middle income, upper middle income. I mean, the area median income in the Bay Area is absurdly high because we have chronically underbuilt housing, and the only people who win in that are high income people.
Mm-hmm. So you're talking about other high income people here who are trying to increase housing because they kind of want to get in. Basically,
they also want to know that them getting in is not causing damage to other people. Mm-hmm. I think that it doesn't have to be a zero-sum game. I mean, we can really have dense, vibrant, multi-income level housing communities. You can have a low-income person living next door to a high-income person. I mean, my goal in life, my vision, is that we are going to have high-income people living next to low-income people. That high-income person is going to be taxed at a high rate, and that money goes to fund the social services, the public school system, that in their dense, multi-income, mixed-income communities, that low-income people get to take advantage of all the good things that have been happening in high-income neighborhoods for a long time.
And then you mentioned tech workers as a group that's looking to be able to put down roots here as they connect with employment opportunities. Are other industry workers also represented in your group?
Yeah, I mean, I think that it's an interesting thing also, like people from every walk of life are members of the YIMBY party. And I say members in a loosely thing, we have people volunteering on our campaigns and coming out and doing a lot of stuff with us. We have a lot of people in the service industry. I would say that most of the people in the service industry are making significantly less money, and they are struggling to get by, and it is harder for them to make time to come out and volunteer, but, they'll be passionate on Twitter. We have a lot of people who are, sort of generally active in local politics who come out and do a lot of stuff with us. San Francisco is primarily, I would say, tech and service workers are too big. If you're talking about people in the ages of like 25 to 35 who feel the biggest pressure from this, those are the two sort of jobs that are probably biggest.
So if I had to encapsulate what you've said over the last few minutes, your movement, the YIMBY movement, which again stands for Yes in My Backyard, which this is not a YIMBY versus NIMBY debate, but it sort of comes out of that notion that, criticism of San Francisco is of people saying, well, I like my San Francisco the way it is. I don't want it to become more dense or taller because it's, for a variety of reasons. And so this is sort of the alternative to that. Seems to be made up of a largely young group of middle-income workers from a couple of different sectors. And the idea is they want their place at the table too, but they don't want to have to displace other people in order to do so. And that the solution is to just increase housing density.
Yeah, and especially in our wealthy neighborhoods. I think we've seen a lot of development take place in lower-income neighborhoods. Meanwhile, a third of the city is single-family homes. And those are places the West Side could use a lot more housing. And instead of talking about that, you know, we're having distraction issues. You know, everyone talks about protecting their neighborhoods. And that's really hard. I want to say, like, who exactly are you protecting your neighborhood from? You know, who are the people that you don't think should come and join your neighborhood? I think we have the opportunity. When I say mixed in communities, I don't just mean putting wealthy people into low-income neighborhoods. I mean putting low-income people into high-income neighborhoods. I think we need mixed in communities. We've become more segregated over the past 20 years. We have become more segregated both by race and also by income. And I think that a lot of, young people don't like that. They want to see vibrant, mixed-income, multiracial communities where low-income people can find opportunity.
So that was Laura Clark, president of Grow SF. I want to turn to you, Fernando Marti, who is co-director of the Council of Community Housing Organizations. What Laura describes seems to fit a lot with Bay Area values. How do you respond to her vision for how we solve the housing crisis here?
So I think the important part of understanding sort of what a yes in my backyard attitude could be is, I think, what you started off with. Is this about yes in my backyard to any and all kinds of development? Or are we talking about a housing affordability crisis that we are experiencing in San Francisco and in the region that needs to be dealt with through affordable housing policies? And an idea that I think permeates...
And can you say what's the difference there?
So for one thing, just sort of the name YIMBY, I think, sets it up as it's YIMBYs versus NIMBYs, right? And it's NIMBYs who have created the conditions that we're in today, that housing is so unaffordable because of NIMBYs. On the other hand, Laura said a number of things, including income inequality. We are in one of the areas with the highest income inequality in the country, with the greatest sort of distance between those who make low-wage jobs and those who make high-wage jobs. And within that, the growth has been, if you look over the years, has been both at the low end and at the upper end. So the city economist likes to say that for every tech job, we have five other support jobs that are created, service worker jobs and all sorts of sectors. And yet, what the market is building is only housing for that upper income level. And so if we are going to address our housing needs, that means we need to be addressing the housing needs for folks at the lower to middle income levels. And you're not going to do that by building more luxury housing. And I think that's the primary difference between us is, are we going to direct our policies towards building actual affordable housing, or are we going to direct our policies or basically get rid of policies in order to get more market rate housing at the luxury end? I want to add one other thing, which I think, you start off saying we come from the same progressive values. And I think that it's very important to understand what we mean by progressive values. And I know that a lot of the folks who support YIMBY and Grow SF would identify themselves as progressives, even though a lot of their funding comes from a group that's called SF Moderates. So that's another question.
That's not true.
But
I'll let you respond in a moment.
We can go through where the money comes from. But I think that a question about having progressive values, whether it is about respecting immigrant rights or whether it is about maintaining a diverse community where people who might be fleeing other repressive places can come to, means that we're talking about people, flesh and blood people who live in real places. They need real homes in real buildings, and they need to be able to afford those homes. So progressive values are very much intertwined with land use battles that we have. Who is going to build? For whom? Who is going to be able to afford that housing? And who is going to make decisions about what gets built? And all of those things, you can't separate progressive values in terms of social values from a perspective on land use and what gets built in a city.
So to your mind, what is wrong with Laura's vision in the sense of why can't it be affordable if we're trying to increase the density? She is saying that she would like to have all income levels living side by side.
Yeah.
Why are you not biting
so
there?
I think there's something about the idea that's very appealing, right? We build more market rate housing. We overbuild market rate housing. And then when the next, downturn in the economy comes around, we're going to have too much market rate housing and people will be able to afford that housing. And it is an economic model that tries to place how we understand supply and demand on a regional basis into our little tiny city. So if you want to talk about how the market, real estate market creates affordable housing, you go for where it's cheaper to build, tract homes in, Cowfield somewhere. And you go where it's less attractive to build, Antioch, let's say. And if you want to build housing for rich people, you build it where it is might be more expensive, so high density towers, and where it is very appealing for folks with money. And that is what the market creates. And so if we're trying to solve a problem, which is that the market is not creating housing that is affordable to regular people in San Francisco, we can't solve that market failure by asking the market to do more. The market just doesn't do it. So that's a difference in kind of how we see the world, right? And you might describe how you see the world in a different frame. So then I think we need evidence. What are the facts? Do the facts support my vision of the world? And I would point to two things that I think represent facts that prove what I'm saying. One is that over the last 20 years in San Francisco, despite what Laura has said that we have been chronically underbuilding, it might be true that we've been chronically underbuilding, who the we is. We, the city of San Francisco, has been approving and titling, it's called, far more units than actually get built, about 700 more every year. So right now we have a backlog of 19,000 approved projects, not counting the shipyard and Treasure Island and Park Merced. They're ready to go. There's no NIMBY stopping them. There's no environmental review stopping them. There's no anything stopping them. The market is just not building them. And so that's the first thing, and you can just look at the data. The second is then part of our solution, and it's the main part of our solution that I think we disagree with GrowSF, although GrowSF is supportive of inclusionary housing, is that we believe we need to harness the market for the most that we can feasibly do to get the market to build mixed-income communities. So in San Francisco, we have one of the highest inclusionary housing policies. We're going through economic analysis, what will make sense, right? We passed it in 2002 when Mark Leno was a supervisor. He sponsored the first inclusionary housing ordinance. One would imagine that going from 0 to 12%, so forcing all developers to build 12% of their units as affordable units, would have killed the market. And it was done very carefully with its grandfathering, so it didn't affect any projects that were already moving forward. A year later, approvals soared, right? In 2006, we upped it to 15%. A year later, approvals soared. Another year later, approvals crashed because it was 2008. And so it gets back to, I think, to me, the question that we're dealing with is it's the market that rules, as Bill Clinton liked to say. It's the economy, right? It's the economy that is at the basis. We're arguing over what I think is an easy target. And there are NIMBYs out there, right? It's a lot of them who say, I don't want this housing. I don't want this deck blocking my view. So let's attack those guys, right? But it doesn't – that attack doesn't address the problem. That is, we need to increase supply of affordable housing if we are to maintain our progressive values, if we are to maintain a diverse city.
Okay. So I want you to give you a chance, Laura. There's lots there to respond to. First is kind of what are the political winds that are supporting you, where your money's coming from, and this notion of that the market itself cannot be the solution. Is that a fair characterization of what your organization is espousing?
No. The idea that we should harness the market for mixed-income communities, I think, is completely in line with what we want to do. We do that through good government regulation. I think we are very pro-regulation. You made reference to changing what's called the inclusionary zoning. So that's the percentage for market rate projects that goes to subsidized low income. I think that's a great program. I mean, he's right. GrowSF is very much in favor of that. And I think we did see, 12% and 15% did not affect the total number of affordable housing units that came out of that. That's great. And then we upped it to 25%. And the number of projects and the number of potential affordable subsidized units that we had has cratered. And I think that we know that the city controller, that's the city economist, has come out with a report saying that the way to maximize the total number of affordable housing units is to peg that at 18%. And I know that we're getting sort of in the weeds there, but it is a focus on what can we do as far as government regulation that maximizes the total number. Because we spend a lot of time in San Francisco arguing about percentage, and actually the most important thing we need to be doing is getting as many subsidized affordable units on the market and as many regular market rate units on the market. I think the fundamental question is, do you believe that we are in a housing shortage? Or do you believe that we are in an affordability crisis? And I have never heard a good definition of what an affordability crisis, what is supposedly causing an affordability crisis. It seems to me very obvious that we are in a shortage, that there is not enough to go around. And in any shortage, high-income people win. When you have any kind of a shortage, the person who can bid it up the highest wins. And that is what we are seeing right now. And I think it is a disaster. I think that it's a disaster not just in San Francisco, but throughout the Bay Area. I think we have seen all of our South Bay communities be very comfortable adding large job complexes and building no units of housing, regular apartments that people could live in. They're barely building single-family homes. I think it's a complete disaster throughout the region. And I think if we continue to think narrowly just about San Francisco and not think about the impact of all of these little communities on the regional Bay Area, we're going to continue to watch this disaster unfold. For instance, Millbrae. There is a project on the right on top of the Millbrae BART station that could have hundreds of apartments right on a high public transit area, and the local community there is fighting it tooth and nail. And I do think that that is just pure NIMBYism. I think people are worried about parking, and I think people are worried that their community is going to change. And what that happens is that the community does change. If you don't build housing, your community changes. You lose, maybe you don't lose your neighborhood character, but you lose the characters who can live in your neighborhood. You lose the people. And I would agree with Fernando. This is about people. I think that being a sanctuary state has no meaning if you cannot afford to live in the Bay Area. To say that we were welcoming to immigrants is a completely meaningless statement if the rent is $3,000, $4,000 a month. A family cannot afford to live here. There were two other things that were brought up that I think it's good to think about as we go forward. You know, two of the questions that Fernando brought up is, you know, who's going to build this and who is going to make decisions about land use? And I will say that this is a thing that the YIMBYs don't really care about. Who's going to build it is just not a question that we care that much about. Somebody maybe is going to make money building housing. If that means that a lot of people get homes, then that's great. I don't care who's going to build it. If we can sum up a huge amount of money to build it all public housing, I would be for that. If there's a mystery pot of money that somebody can put towards building the stuff that Fernando is a big advocate for, the subsidized affordable housing that's built by nonprofit developers, if there's a secret pot of money that we can throw at these nonprofit developers, I will be there fighting for that. I think there are policies that we are already advocating for. You know, we're looking into a vacancy tax that could potentially fund subsidized affordable housing. I think we do need more subsidized affordable housing. But I haven't seen a secret pot of money that California is willing to put towards this. And so I do think that the market is willing to build these units. I think that if the market was so unwilling to build these housing units, we wouldn't need exclusionary zoning, right? We wouldn't need to have single-family home-only zoning if they didn't need to keep developers out. You know, do you understand what I'm saying?
So I want to give you a chance to respond to the question of where your money comes from, though. Would you like to respond to that?
I mean, sure. I mean, the most of our money, so I think for Grow SF, 97, I think was the last time I did the math, percent of our donations were under $150. They come a lot from people who, mostly from our volunteers, you know, people who come out and see the work that we're doing. And that's really inspiring to me. Another source of money is some of the mass employers in the area have given us, you know, sort of medium-sized checks. I think it makes a lot of sense. Anybody who employs a lot of people in the area should be frustrated with the fact that they are paying people either a good or a very good wage, and their workers are being immiserated by the housing crisis. So I think it makes total sense. Grow SF, I can say, has not received any money from any developer ever. I think that's because they know that we're going to show up and support their projects anyway. So they don't really need to buy us off. But, you know, I think we get a lot of money from stunted millennials, as I like to joke, you know, people who have enough disposable income to make a small donation, but not enough money to buy the housing that they feel like they want, you know, not enough money to buy housing and start a family, honestly.
So just out of fairness there, Fernando, where does your organization get its money?
Sure. And let me, pardon me, Laura, you have various hats. So I think I was confusing your YIMBY party hat and your RFK Democratic Club hat, which I think does have SF Moderates, which is the realtors in there. So my apologies in confusing that. But to your question, our funding is about a quarter or a third in individual small donations, similar to Grow SF. We get about half of our funding from philanthropic organizations, and then another quarter or so from our member organizations. And we have several. We're a coalition of 24 affordable housing developers and advocates, going everything from you know, Mercy Housing or a TNDC or the large kind of developers that are based in San Francisco, to groups like Senior and Disability Action and Poder, environmental justice groups, and so forth, who are part of our coalition.
So you wanted to say one more thing there. Go ahead,
Laura. I just want to clarify. I volunteer with a local Democratic club known as the Robert F. Kennedy Democratic Club, and I'm on the board as a volunteer board member who receives no money from that organization, and I think that they do great work and do a lot of advocacy in politics. I think it's unfortunate that I think it's unfortunate that we question, each other's motives quite as much around where money is coming from rather than listening to what people are saying. And I think that the YIMBY party is made up of a lot of very earnest people, sometimes overly earnest people, I would say, you know, who care very deeply about this issue. And I one of the things that I think you mentioned about progressivism, it has been one of the most disappointing parts of my advocacy in San Francisco is to have my motives questioned over and over and over again, and to be told by people who I have and will continue to want to be future allies that they believe that I don't care about the welfare of low-income people when, you know, maybe I'm misguided. I don't think that I am, obviously, but I think that what I am doing is advocating for the well-being of low-income people. Because the truth is, in a housing shortage, the rich people are going to be fine. They can't afford to scoop up that little bit of existing housing. Mm-hmm. The people who lose in a housing shortage are middle and low-income people. And yes, we're going to have some amount of subsidized low-income housing, so some lucky few are going to win that lottery and get those subsidized low-income housing. And I want to maximize that number. I want as many people to win that lottery as possible. But I also want people to be able to live in this city, you know, for the next 50 years.
Right. So it seems like the end game in some ways is the same, right? We want more. Yep. But the question is, how do you get there? And that's where the difference lies. I need to reintroduce the program first, though, mm-hmm. before we get into nitty-gritty about that. This is City Visions on Local Public Radio, 91.7 KALW San Francisco, and on the web at KALW.org. I'm Joseph Pache. And tonight, our guests are Laura Clark, president of Grow SF, and Fernando Marti, who is co-director of the Council of Community Housing Organizations. We invite you, our listeners, to join us by phone. You can dial us at 415-841-4134. Again, that's 415-841-4134. You can email or text us at cityvisions@kalw.org, post a comment at the KLW website, or you can tweet us at cityvisionskalw. So, Fernando, I noticed in the last set of comments that just previous to this last set of comments that Laura was making, that you were nodding quite a bit. So what is it that made you feel like you were more in agreement perhaps than you were earlier on in the hour?
Well, I think I don't know if we're in agreement in terms of policy solutions, but I think the framing makes a lot of sense, right? We have a housing shortage, right? And the question is it a housing shortage of luxury units, or is it a shortage of affordable units that regular people can afford? And as a policy question, I think Laura raises a very good point, right? Do we have a secret pot of money for building subsidized housing? I think the assumption there is that investors have a secret pot of money for overbuilding luxury units and basically driving their own profits down, right? And regionally, that may be the case, right? Because housing markets are regional. But in San Francisco, as we looked at the data over the last 20 years, we approve way more than the market builds. So what's happening? The market is building for a certain price point, and when that price point starts to be filled in San Francisco, the market goes away. The market, the investor market, has a lot of choices, right? They can go to Saudi Arabia, they can go to China, they can go to, there's a whole bunch of places. And what's happening is, because, you know, we might argue with developers about the amount of inclusionary housing, but we talk to market rate developers all the time. And the developers are telling us that investment's already starting to get a little lean, right? That investors are starting to get scared. And whether it's because we're now in the second longest economic recovery in recent history or because of the new administration, those cranes may very well go away, right? And the solution that is presented, I think, so correct me if I'm wrong, by groups like Grow SF and the YIMBY party is that the problem is these NIMBYs in San Francisco. And yet the facts show that we're approving more than we actually get built. Now, the other part that Laura said, which I was nodding vigorously, is, well, what about talking about the region as a whole, right? And there we get into a question. You know, if you look at San Francisco and what we've done in San Francisco, we took all our industrial areas, right? We took Mission Bay, and we upzoned it so we could build housing on it. And we required that there be 30% affordable housing in that area. We took the Transbay area and made it 35% affordable and poured a lot of money into it, right? There's a lot of investment that's going into that. We did Eastern Neighborhoods and Market Octavia, and you walk down Market Street near Castro and you see all these high-rises going on. And then we had to have a fight with the developers to make sure they actually built their affordable housing on site, that they didn't just pay a fee and get out of it, right? And those fights that we had, so Market Octavia is the big one, because the redevelopment areas, we had the rules set out. The rules were this: you're going to build the on-site housing, you're going to give us these sites, we're going to build this with subsidies, we're going to build you the streets, we're going to build you the transit. This is how it works, right? In these other areas, that's just a bunch of market rate developers. The community needs to fight to get those developers to actually build their on-site units. And what happens is the developers will come back and say, after we've passed the rules, we'll say, hey, what if instead of building 20 family units, you let me build 30 micro units? It's like, okay, that's cool. How much more profit do you have? How much more affordable can we get back? Oh, no. I don't want to talk about that, right? Or a developer comes and says, you know, I got this great project, but wouldn't it be great if I could add twice as many floors, right? And I don't want to say that GrowSF will necessarily say this is great, build twice as many floors.
We will happily say that is great.
We will say, and how much profit is that giving you, or is that giving the land? And how much more affordable housing can you provide? Because we know that building the twice as many units is not going to bring prices down. Why? Because we look at history and we know that when the economy changes a little, the cranes go away and we're not overbuilding market rate housing. In the 1950s, if you were talking about building suburbs on cow fields and overbuilding those and having people from Concord move into Walnut Creek or move to Danville, to Blackhawk, and having them open up some old dilapidated housing and someone from Pittsburgh maybe moving up to Concord, that kind of idea kind of worked, right? Nobody is saying that our old Victorians are suddenly becoming more affordable because somebody moved into some new high-rise that got built, right? We've got Mark Zuckerberg driving around looking for old Victorians to buy and convert to his new house, right? This is who's buying those old houses. That story is a story from the 50s that does not work in the San Francisco of today. So we're in a conundrum, because I think one of the things that Laura raised is a very good point, right? We don't have a secret pot of money to build affordable housing. I challenge her that the investors don't have a secret pot of money to overbuild market rate housing and drive themselves out of business, right? So then what do we do? And so I'd look across the table and I say, hey, Laura, let's work on a funding stream for affordable housing, because A, we know that works for the diversity of people that we all say we're talking about, but B, it works across economic cycles. So in 2009, when the economy tanked and all those cranes went away, 50% of what was being built was affordable housing, was public investment, because when the market goes away, it goes away. We've committed the money, we're moving forward, we're keeping jobs in the area. And that's the kind of solution that we need to all be working forward if we're going to be true about both serving the diversity of people, but also looking at the facts on the ground about how the market actually works in San Francisco.
So here again to you, Laura, is what Fernando is describing seems to maybe meet your needs and meet your goals. Why aren't you biting?
I think there is this idea that there are no disincentives currently, that the market right now is just operating, which I think is fantasy. We have created a net of disincentives to building. We have made it incredibly difficult to build housing in San Francisco. And so why should it be surprising that when we make it just a little bit harder, all of the market rate housing developers disappear. I think that we have a net of policies that mean that it takes years to get your permits entitled. We have the California CEQA that creates opportunities for people to do lawsuits and add shadow studies, and we keep limits on how tall you can build the buildings, and we keep limits on how many units. We have a whole net of disincentives, not to mention we have exclusionary zoning where a third of the city is mandated to be single-family homes when we're having a housing crisis. Single-family homes, might I add, that entire policy comes out of segregation, red line districting, and historical racism. Those policies were designed to keep low-income and minority people out of neighborhoods, and they work. This is a crisis. We could be upzoning the entire West Side, and I know that makes people feel uncomfortable. You know, they worry that their neighborhood is going to change. But if you look at San Francisco, it has changed. It is changing. I think Fernando and I agree on one thing, which is that luxury housing comes in all shapes, sizes, and ages. Victorian's older housing is now luxury housing because we are experiencing a shortage. All of the existing housing is in short supply. All of it is therefore at extremely inflated prices. The only way to deal with that is by building a lot more. And the YIMBY Party acts regionally. We believe that this needs to happen regionally as well as locally. But there's a huge amount of potential here in San Francisco. There are a huge number of single-story retail places surrounded by parking. There's that horrific Safeway at Church and Market that I pass almost every day on my way to work that is built like we're out in the middle of the burbs and like land value has no value at all. You know, we have potential here in San Francisco to really address this crisis, and we have policies that stand in the way of that. And I think, you know, if we were running the experiment where we had allowed the market to build a lot of housing and then, oh, look, the market hadn't built that, then maybe we would be having a conversation. You know, I would love to be proved wrong, but we haven't run that experiment. We have created a net of policies that have made it impossible to build housing at the rate that we needed to for 30 plus years.
So I just want to reintroduce the program at this point. You'll get a chance to respond. This is City Visions on Local Public Radio 91.7 KLW San Francisco and on the web at klw.org. I'm Joseph Pache, and tonight our guests are Laura Clark, president of GrowSF, and Fernando Marti, who is co-director of the Council of Community Housing Organizations. Again, our phone number to dial to join our conversation, 415-841-4134. Again, 415-841-4134. You can email or text us at cityvisions@klw.org. Post a comment at the KLW website or tweet us at City Visions KLW. So I'm going to ask you to make it a brief response because I have a few emails and some calls to get to.
So I would argue that we have made that experiment, and we are in the middle of that experiment of how much market rate housing and affordable housing we can build in San Francisco. We've upzoned the entire east side of the city. I spent all of 2001 to 2008.
And it took us 10 years.
It took us 10 years.
That's too
to
slow.
Figure out how to upzone. We upzoned Mission Bay. We upzoned Trans Bay. And within that, there were forces who were saying that the future of San Francisco was in commercial development. It was not in housing. And we were arguing, we've been arguing since the 80s, that commercial development has to be linked to housing and that housing has to reflect the income levels of the jobs being created. Housing cannot exist outside of an economic development strategy. And the counter to that is let the market build whatever it builds. And if the market doesn't create housing that people can afford, Antioch is out there for you. And we don't believe that is either fair, we don't believe that creates a diverse city, and we don't believe it's sustainable because those service workers are still going to be working here in San Francisco, and they're going to be driving from long distances to get to a BART station, to get to here, and that is not the future that we want to build.
But I don't think you're saying that either, that Antioch is there for you. For
no,
the people.
Poor
Antioch. I'm waiting for the callers Antioch.
But I will also say that Antioch needs more housing too. You know, I mean, there are people in Antioch who are struggling to get by. I think this is another thing where all of our suburbs have also, you know, unlike Some of the other cities in America, the reason why the problem is so much worse in San Francisco is because we don't have an incorporated regional government. We have toothless housing goals. And I would agree that there needs to be a lot more relationship between jobs added and housing added. The Google complex, the Facebook, all went in without any corresponding housing going in. And our suburbs need to be held accountable for that. I think it's completely inappropriate. I go down to hearings down in the South Bay where people will be, you know, more overtly racist about it, actually. You know, I was at a hearing in Brisbane, which touches San Francisco, and one of the first speakers that got up to speak against a proposed housing project said she didn't want to be a minority in her own home. And that one stuck with me. You know, I think that this is a regional problem.
Absolutely. And I think I completely agree with that. Again, our solutions, I think that if our solutions are simply about calling out NIMBYs and saying that it is certain policies, it misses the larger economic incentives and economic points about how cities develop and how regions develop. We have Prop 13 in California, which leads cities to make decisions around prioritizing commercial development because that's going to bring in business taxes, that's going to bring in sales taxes, and not prioritize housing development. We've got to deal with that, right? We have policies where we want to build infrastructure for the region, right? We want to build a new high-speed rail. We want to build a second BART line, right? Can we link those investments to building a range of affordable housing, right? If you, Brisbane, don't build the housing that you're required to build and you don't build the percentage of affordable housing, so this is where we would disagree, then maybe we're never going to support, you know, Caltrans is just not going to build that new off-ramp for you. And until you get there, we're not going to do that. The state went on an experiment, so talking about experiments, in the 80s and 90s to transform our Central Valley into a place for prisons. And Central Valley towns wouldn't want prisons. Why would you want a prison? The state said, hey, we'll build you some new highways. We'll build you some new schools. We're going to get you to do what they said was the right thing, which I believe is absolutely the wrong thing. But they did it by enticing those towns with the state putting in the infrastructure that they wanted, right? If we want to do that here in the Bay Area, and I completely agree with Laura, we have no regional governance. There's only one area in the United States, Minneapolis, that has close to a somewhat regional governance that can actually start to deal with housing at a regional level. We need to make sure that the Metropolitan Transportation Commission, which handles all the federal money for transportation, links that money to affordable housing goals, region by region, sub-region by sub-region, county by county, right? So one of the things that Laura brings up is that suburbs haven't done their fair share, right? So San Francisco, we've got the numbers of, and I think Laura and I might argue about whether RENA, the Regional Housing Needs Assessment, is the right metric to use. Doesn't matter. It's a metric, and it's a metric that's based more or less on job growth and job growth at different income levels, which is the key thing. So in the last cycle that this analysis was done in San Francisco, guess what? We built over 100% of the market rate housing equivalent to the jobs built right here.
Now, but that was based on 2010 right, numbers.
And we're far below because we're housing people from the entire region, right? But how much did we build of affordable housing, right? We built 60% of the very low-income need. We built 27% of the low-income need. We built 18% of the moderate income need. Now, those numbers might be low. They're below all the way across that spectrum, right? So this what we're building is more and more and more imbalanced between the need for the very low-income people and the need created by high-income jobs. we've got to get that balance back in line with the jobs that are being created.
So I'm going to go to a few comments here as we get a few calls in here. We have an email from Catherine. It says, I'm very concerned about the build at any cost to the environment approach. We haven't talked about the environment here. To housing that many pro-market rate development advocates are supporting with a tax on CEQA, the California Environmental Quality Act, on open space, on backyard habitats, and on protecting our parks from shadows. The public is losing the little protection that is in place now for protecting the environment. Zoning and a thoughtful planning process with public input are vital to protect nature for both wildlife and for future generations. I'm going to read a few more and then have you comment on them.
Oh, we're going to lose track of things. That's a big question, though. I think we should take it.
So environmental impact of a development. Mm-hmm. A tweet. Where do you get the money to build affordable housing if you don't build market rate housing? The federal government in California has abandoned the Bay Area. Another tweet. The West Side, meaning the West Side of San Francisco, could use a lot more housing. So someone going on your side there, Laura. And then we also have, let's see here, an email from Kathleen who says, you have to talk about the regional issues. So just kind of saying what you've both been saying here. If you're really going to address these very complex issues, including diverse and affordable housing, Oakland is reeling from the impact of the housing crunch in San Francisco. What Bay Area-wide organizations are looking into this as a regional problem and long-term? Any Bay Area-wide resolutions? So, whoa. A few things there. We have a few calls
so
to get to
about
as well.
Environmentalism.
Yeah, why don't you talk about environmentalism?
Yeah, I think there's a misconception that building dense urban housing is not environmental, when in fact the opposite is the case. We have a choice. People are going to live in homes. So are you going to build dense urban infill? That means building on existing urban spaces that have already suffered the human impact? Are you going to build dense around walkable neighborhoods? Are you going to build around transit-rich areas? Or are you going to keep building from happening in those places and therefore cause suburban sprawl? We believe that building more housing in existing urban areas is environmental, and the data bears that out. People who live in dense urban places use less water, they drive less, there's a whole series of metrics in which they live greener lifestyles and also for themselves physically healthier. So while there are a few things, like nobody's proposing building housing on public parks. That's just not a thing. The YIMBY movement wouldn't be in favor of that. We all live in dense cities and we like going to Dolores and having our picnics, so that's just not a thing that we would be for. But I do think that we would be okay with, some shadows falling on some parks. I think that that is not a true negative environmental impact. I think that if you're talking about true environmentalism, we can't fear the shadows. We have to do things to, stop suburban sprawl and stop a car-centric lifestyle.
Fernando, any of those comments that you wanted to briefly make a comment? Now we have a couple of calls I want to get to before the end of the hour.
Absolutely. I think I was going to echo the question. I think that the primary environmental issue that we face today is how to get people out of cars and how to move our energy consumption into renewable resources. And so I think, like Laura, I fully believe in dense urban areas. Now, what our studies show that when you build transit-oriented development that is all market-rate housing, those people still have cars, and they still drive those cars. And when you build affordable housing as transit-oriented development, the car use is reduced tremendously. And so I'm not saying we shouldn't build any market-rate housing near transit. But this question of balance, again, is key. We talked earlier about, median income, whatever it is. Only the top 10% of income earners can afford new housing in San Francisco. That's outrageous. So we have to create solutions that go across the income spectrum.
So in the last 5 minutes of the program, let's go to a couple of calls here. We have a call from Bill. Bill, where are you calling from?
Hi, I'm calling from San Francisco.
Go ahead.
I haven't heard, I didn't I didn't hear the beginning of the program, but clearly Airbnb has affected housing in San Francisco in a negative way. In a San Francisco Chronicle article, series of articles in 2015, as of the end of 2014, the majority of Airbnb listings were whole apartments or houses. And that was created. There was a government policy. It bailed out the banks and insurance companies and the real estate trusts and industry. And meanwhile, what happened was there were a lot of foreclosures. Three zip codes: 9411, Bayview, Hunters Point, and Viz Valley represented more than 50% of all the foreclosures. Now, I'm not saying that that would make, if you took all those Airbnbs and made them rental housing, that would solve the problem of affordable housing.
But it's an area that we haven't focused on.
It certainly is. And what we have is a private sector saying, we're going to do what we want to do. It's kind of like the Uber. We're going to do what we want to do, and we're going to prevent you from regulating it.
We're going to have to cut it there. Thanks, Bill. Do you want to respond there, Laura?
Yeah, I think that my favorite policy for regulating Airbnb more intensely would be just to increase the hotel tax. I think that we can create a lot of the hotels could be converted into housing as well. I have no problem even with getting rid of Airbnb entirely. I would trade that for upzoning the West Side. But I also think that these are fights about the existing housing stock. The real point of YIMBY is that we don't want to fight over the existing housing stock.
We need a bigger pie.
We need a bigger pie.
Well, let's go next to Erin in Berkeley. Erin?
Hi.
Yes, go ahead.
So I'm hearing a lot of people getting written off as NIMBYs or as development obstructionists in San Francisco these days. And I'm wondering if the speakers can get into the difference between NIMBYs and people who are fighting against gentrification and displacement in their communities.
All right. Thank you so much, Erin, for your comment there. So,
yeah, I have lots of opinions about this. I mean, for me, the people who see a project and say, we need more housing, I have concerns about this project, and they are concerns that can be worked with, and we can get over this, and then you can go and build the project, I wouldn't call that person a NIMBY. I would call that person somebody who wants to see something specific about a project addressed, you know, if they have a reasonable, actionable, you know, concern. I think that the biggest problem with gentrification, with the gentrification fight we're having in San Francisco, is that if you're fighting gentrification in a low-income neighborhood, fundamentally that means that you're fighting a losing battle, because we should have been building housing in wealthy neighborhoods 20 years ago. That they are suffering from the pressure placed on them by the fact that the West Side and the South Bay has chronically underbuilt housing. And I have a massive amount of empathy for low-income people who look at the condos and they say, rich people live in those condos, rich people are moving into my neighborhood, what can I do to stop this, because I'm trying to hold on. And it's a very hard argument to say the solution is to build a lot more housing to take the pressure off of you. It's what I believe is true, but I understand.
But what happens in the meantime?
Yeah.
Right?
So I think that there is a lot of accusations of community activists as being NIMBYs because they want to get a better project out of development, right? Development, and I think we have a very different opinion about this, but you know, it's. I think you're right, Laura. It's not about who builds the project, but how those developers approach working in an existing community. And it's part of why we can say, you know, we've done incredible work in Mission Bay or Trans Bay, building where there weren't existing people. In a place like the Mission, you have to respect the people who live and work and held that place before, quote unquote, people decided they wanted to move back into the city.
So so different strategies for where you're building in the first place, whether there are people already living there. So I apologize to all the callers that we didn't get a chance to get to, especially the one, Vincent in San Francisco, says, where's the common ground between these two guests?
Prop 13. We could have a whole episode about how we're going to agree that we need to repeal Prop 13.
And regional governance and suburban issues.
Yes. There you go, Vincent. I hope that's a good enough answer for you. And that's City Visions for this evening. Our guests tonight were Laura Clark, president of Grow SF, and Fernando Marti, co-director of the Council of Community Housing Organizations. Thanks to the both of you for joining me this evening.
Thank you so much for having us.
Thank you.
For a link to this and other City Visions shows, to let us know what you thought about tonight's program, to subscribe to alerts and download podcasts, visit the City Visions page at klw.org. Our engineer this evening was David LaTulipe. Tonight's show was produced by Wendy Holcomb. We'll be off next Monday for the MLK holiday. We'll be back in 2 weeks. This is Joseph Pache. Thanks for listening. Good night.
Now is a great time to become a new member of KALW and to help us launch our next 75 years on the air. Find all the details by clicking the donate button at the top of KALW.org. And thanks. David LaTulipe with an admonition to take care as you're going around the Bay Area, especially if you're driving. Trees have been loosened. There's more rain on the way. Those trees may fall in all kinds of unexpected areas, so be careful where you park as well. We may get an additional 1 inch of rain tomorrow with some winds accompanying that. So take care of yourselves, please. And a little extra courtesy on the roadways goes a long way. This is 91.7 KALW San Francisco.